Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by one of my favorite people in the entire sport, John Danowski, live from Durham, North Carolina. Coach Dino, how you doing?
Great morning, Terry. Thanks. It's great to see your face, and thanks for the opportunity to talk to you today.
We're talking about one of the most exciting topics in the entire world, which is obviously Taylor Swift's appearance on the New Heights podcast.
Let's go.
I actually, one thing that came up recently that I wanted to set the record straight, Bob Carpenter, Duke alum, founder of Inside Lacrosse, appears to be less familiar than he should be with your days of spinning vinyl at Hofstra. Can you fill the folks in on your long tenure with the audio format?
WRHU 88.7 Radio, Hofstra University. This is Uncharted Territory, and I'm John Danowski. We play tomorrow's hits today. It's now 4:01 a.m. here in Hempstead, New York. And here's something from The Fray. And that was like, it was something I was always fell in love with radio. You know, obviously younger. I used to listen, obviously to the local New York stations. But I used to listen to games, basketball, Kentucky, AM short, bounce off the ionosphere, the radio waves. So at night, it becomes, there's more distance. And so you could listen, and that was always very exciting. Kaywood Ledford was the announcer for Kentucky basketball. And, those were the days when there were, 6-7 radio, TV stations. And not a lot of content on TV, like today. So, radio was a big part of growing up.
How do you describe your taste?
In terms of music? Eclectic, I guess. Everything.
Very good.
Classical music, jazz, hip-hop, rock, southern rock, not bluegrass, but I'm getting used
there
to
you
it,
go.
You know, a little bit country, so.
Yeah. Nice. Well, yeah, you're in the heart of bluegrass country. So there's no question that you're going to have to give that. It's going to grow on you, I suppose, is the way that I would put it. But in reality, we are here to talk about recruiting. It is one of the most frequently discussed topics in the sport, and I think the role of these conversations is intended to try to take a process that many people find to be opaque and give it a little bit of clarity. And you've been doing it for a really long time, and you've seen it evolve a lot, and that's where I want to start the conversation. But with that being said, there are two questions that I like to begin every conversation with, which are, well, I'll ask the first one first. How do you regard it? Specifically, one truism that a lot of coaches say is that recruiting is the lifeblood of your program. Do you agree with that, or would you modify that?
No, absolutely. When you have better players, you're a better coach. there's no getting around that.
And then the second question is, how do you describe yourself as a talent evaluator?
I've always thought that beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. And people ask me, what do you look for, right? And the answer is really simple. I look for it, meaning you know it when you see it. But, this is not like football where the outside linebacker has to be 6'2", 215. There's certain metrics that he has to possess in order to be recruited. For us, you could be 5'6". You could be 6'7". You could be the fastest guy in the team. You could be the slowest. You could have, but there's something that has to separate you from something that fits your needs as your program. For some years it could be a goalie, a draw man, a left-handed attackman. Short stick committee, while they're more and more now in high school, a lot of times it's just that next best athlete who's not playing on offense.
Yep.
But it you know, refers to equality. It could be competitiveness. It could be leadership. It could be potential.
So I want to come back to that. But like I said, this is something that has evolved pretty dramatically over the course of your career. And so, you know, given your experience, I want to take advantage of that and start by just reflecting on how it started. So when you think back to the early days of being the head coach at Hofstra, how would you describe recruiting then?
You know, I would even go back a little bit further to CW Post, okay, which was my first foray into that. Now, I had coached football at Columbia. And, you know, I was the grad assistant, freshman football coach. And that was my first taste of really watching college recruiting from a whole different perspective. Now, the rules were different in those days. They used to bring the student athletes into Manhattan. They would take them to Broadway shows. They would take them to Ranger Nick games, take them out to the best restaurants. And so that was my first kind of look at, you know, like who is interested in coming to Manhattan,
sure,
you know, going to school and with Columbia, with all its positives. And also there was some negatives, right, as well. So at Post, it was the same thing. It was, you know, you get yourself out of camps, you make yourself known. In those days, you go to the Rutgers lacrosse camp, and you were able to give a recruiting speech in front of a lot of kids. You relied on the coaches that you knew, relationships that were already formed. There were a couple of, you know, even in those days at Post, we were looking for two sport athletes, kids who were interested in playing both football and lacrosse. So, you know, it was a combination. It was more about relationships. It was more about, and on Long Island, it was easy to go out and watch kids play on a Saturday morning or a Saturday up, you know, before one of your games,
sure,
you know, maybe during the week if you had a day off of practice. So it was a little bit easier to watch people during the regular season. And it was later.
Right.
You know, we were talking to seniors.
So then, kind of shifting to the early stage of your Duke career, where I would imagine, I guess the first question I'm asking is, you know, at that point, how much had the landscape changed, and how much of the, you know, mid to late 2000s had evolved relative to, you know, the time period you just described? And then secondly, how significant was it from going to a place where you just described how easy it was to see a lot of, you know, Hofstra prospects play high school lacrosse. Mm-hmm. You know, at Duke, that wasn't the case. You were recruiting nationally and recruiting a different type of player. So how do you describe that transition, and how do you describe what it was like being at Duke from, say, the window of 2007 to 2012, or, you know, whatever kind of line of demarcation you would get or put for now this more recent point of evolution?
Yeah, you know, I even think back to the Hofstra days. I thought of a story where there was a young man who actually ended up coming to Hofstra. He was up from Syracuse area. And I remember on the phone, Hofstra, Hofstra, we're about 35 minutes, you know, west of Manhattan. You know, he had never heard of Hofstra. And he had a great career for it. But, you know, you had a little bit of that.
Yeah.
Clearly that doesn't exist anymore. But at Duke, the first thing was 9 admission spots. So, you know, we have 36 total. And when you look at trying to, you know, kind of look at your shopping list, so to speak, we kind of use the 2-3-2 model, meaning 2 attackmen, 3 midfielders, 2 defensemen, 2 wild cards.
Yep.
Perhaps a goalie, perhaps a faceoff man, a legacy, a prospect, you know, developmental spot, and or any or all of the above, or the next best player, right? So that was the first, because I'd never been limited, you know, in terms of that, right? And so now you took a look at who was returning, how that, you know, how it matches up. You know, what is it that we need? What are our needs for this particular year? And it doesn't seem so daunting when you say, well, we got in those days now, at the beginning, it was 3 years of it. They were looking at sophomores. Right. We have 3 years to find two attackmen in North America who would be interested in coming to Duke. So it didn't seem so overwhelming. The second part of it was the academic piece. The academic piece was no disrespect to my first two institutions, but, you know, it was more A's than B's, no C's on your transcript, honors classes, and 2 to 4 APs. And that will eliminate some students. It will, the one positive about the early recruiting for Duke in that period, we could get the students early enough and say, listen, here's your deal. If you're interested, you need to change your academic schedule. And in those days, SATs, now we're all test optional, but it was three things. It was the rigor of your classwork. It was your grades. And then third, it was your standardized test score. So it was a combination of those things. And then we also had a little bit of the 2006 atmosphere, which either attracted some students who wanted to be part of a program where you're going to defend the honor of the program, or some that may have shied away from that challenge. So, you know, we had a little bit of that as well.
So that, I mean, there was a lot of really interesting stuff in there, but I want to hone in on the notion of nine admission spots from the standpoint of how you build a roster, particularly in an era when, with an additional year of eligibility, you've spoken a lot about how your roster got bigger and pretty much every college lacrosse roster got bigger. In an era when you were basically dealing with 40 guys on your team, how did you kind of manage it, and how important was it to manage just from the standpoint of making sure that you had enough healthy bodies to practice?
Well, it wasn't, I don't know, it just worked. Yeah. You know, the way I looked at it was this. You know, if you multiply 4 times 2, you have 8 attackmen. 4 times 3, 12 midfielders. 4 times 2, 8 defensemen. And then you have 8 wildcards. So, you know, you can build your team, and you never have 8 attackmen.
Right.
Those, you know, 6, 7, 8 become midfielders. The guys become 260 middies. You know, face-off guys are a part of that mix. And it's the same thing defensively. Guys become LSMs. Guys might even become shortstop.
Right.
So that was never an issue. We really also put a huge emphasis on day one in the weight room. And I can say this. Last year, you know, in the last game against Georgetown, we had 45 healthy guys, and all 45 guys suited up. So between our sports science people, our sports medicine, our strength and conditioning, guys do a really good job of managing,
So one other, you know, really important point in this evolution was the implementation of the rule that eliminated early recruiting and allowed you to start contacting prospective student athletes on September 1st of their junior year. And basically, I would argue, the first class that was predominantly impacted by that just graduated, because with the high school class of 2020, 125 players had committed prior to when that rule went into effect. And we saw a decent number of them change their commitments after they were allowed to start contacting college coaches a little bit more than 2 years after they had made their original commitment. But it was really the class of 21 where it was kind of like opening the floodgates on September 1st. How did that change your approach?
You know, you're always trying to think what's the smartest, most consistent way with your program and how you want your culture to be represented. And that's always a struggle. I wouldn't want somebody calling my son at 12:01, some adult calling a 17-year-old at midnight. I've never done that. And I know people do it. And that's fine. You know, that they're comfortable with that. I know people are enamored with that on the other side. Yeah. But we sent a measured text out at 12:01 and say, listen, you've been identified by the staff. You know, let's talk in the next day or two. We'll be in touch. We identify a very small group initially, about 20 to 25 students, of which, you know, we hope to have some success. That's the original A group. And they may not be interested. There are students who say, hey, listen, thank you, but no thanks. There are those that we, you know, hang in there with a couple of weeks and then they decide to go somewhere else. And then we always go to that next list. But I'm always reminded by the fact that Brendan Fowler was a young man who walked onto our campus to play football. We didn't make one phone call to recruit him. He was a two-time first-team All-American, a two-time NCAA champion, and we didn't make any phone calls. You know, so every once in a while, you do have those outliers as well.
So let me just kind of follow up on that specifically. How does that affect your ability to maintain zen when it comes to the process? Because one of the things that Lars Tiffany said in this conversation a couple years ago that continues to ring in my ears is that on the field, you guys tend to win 7-8 out of 10 games. And so when you're winning at that level of when you're winning at that rate, then, you know, you losing is not common. And it becomes a little bit – you don't have to deal with the emotion of losing as frequently. But, you know, if you're talking to, call it 27 guys in order to get 9 – that suggests maybe you're winning 33% of those recruiting battles against some of your competitors. And so as a result, you're hearing no a little bit more often than you're hearing yes. And I realize that that's less common at Duke than it is at a lot of other places. But it is disappointing to hear no when you really want to recruit. But you just gave an example of you have to maintain some measure of flatness around it because you know that it might end up working out to your program's benefit once it comes to this kid that you didn't realize what he was going to be able to offer. And so, you know, until much later.
Kind of my philosophy at Post, at Hofstra, and here at Duke, I'll say this to every recruit and their family who come in this door, it's about being happy. And if you yourself being happy, you don't come here, you know. And North Carolina, awesome. Virginia, awesome. You want to go to an academy? I would never recruit against a young man who is interested in the academy. Yes, if you want to serve the country and you want to, and that's what you want to do, I'm 100% behind you. If you want to go to Hofstra, UMass, you know, the thing about when I look back, I look back at my time at Post and Hofstra, I do believe this strongly. Everybody ends up where they belong. That's one. And two, at Post, we had guys who became lawyers, DEA agents, teachers, coaches, you know, successful husbands, you know, fathers. Same thing at Hofstra. Teachers, coaches, lawyers, doctors. It was the right place for them, you know. And it's the same thing I believe here at Duke. If there's something that you see that's better somewhere else, I don't want to convince you that, you know, if you don't see this place for what it is, you know, whether it's our staff, our resources, our students, the environment, the geography, whatever you're looking for, you know, we just want to present the, you know, the school, the program, the best light. But at the end of the day, it's the students and their families. And there's also a financial. There's all, you know, you only have so much money to go around. And if you're getting a better offer and the money is better and that's the driving factor, God bless you. I'm not asking you to go into debt to play lacrosse. you know?
So let's just kind of follow up on that a little bit too, because that's the most recent point of evolution. So July 1st of, I believe it was 22, although it may have been 21, the years are bleeding together. The opportunity for student athletes to access NIL payments goes into effect. And, you know, the original intent for that was effectively to allow athletes to speak directly to brands and, you know, do things in that basis. It quickly turned into a different phenomenon with respect to the formation of collectives. And, you know, less influential, I think, in lacrosse than certainly in football and basketball, but certainly a precursor to what we have now seen evolve over the last year, which is the formation of the House settlement, which at the very top of the list includes universities or athletic departments' ability to directly compensate athletes, but includes a lot of other important factors, including for those that opt into the settlement, I want to say quasi-implementation of a roster cap, because there is a half measure in terms of the ability to designate student athletes that might otherwise have lost their opportunity, be it on your roster currently or in the committed classes. And then certainly the elimination of scholarship limits from an NCAA or a conference standpoint, but certainly still the implementation of those limits within departments. And so I also want to set a little bit of kind of pretext for listeners that don't necessarily understand these NCAA rules, but certainly you're limited in terms of your ability to talk about players in the class of 26. They haven't signed their national – well, they haven't signed their – I don't even know what the rule is anymore because the NLI doesn't exist, but right, whatever. Right. We're gonna take that for what it's worth, and certainly you haven't started talking to the 27s yet. So can't get into particulars, and I only bring that up in this context to include that – you haven't recruited under the House settlement yet either, because that wasn't formalized until this summer. So with the caveat that a lot of this is very speculative, what do you say about this current environment?
Well, first of all, that was a mouthful.
I know.
That was a lot.
Which just speaks to the absurdity of the situation, but that's a conversation for another time.
Yeah, you know, for us at Duke, and that's the only thing that I can speak of, because we only have mission spots. Like, our roster will be 41 this academic year. We have two walk-ons that will try out, whether they make the team or not. But we could be as high as 43, but probably 41. And I don't see us ever, now that the pandemic eligibility year is done, and Fuqua, our business school, which is still an attractive for young men, you know, who want to get their message, you know, from Fuqua, that's going to be limited at best. So, you know, and that's with four outside guys. Now, if those four guys didn't come, we'd be down to 37. So for us, that's going to be an issue. The NIL, you know, listen, I'm on the old side of this profession, and I struggle morally with that. I can't ask an alum or a supporter of the program to give us $100 when they could give it to Children's Hospital or the Ronald McDonald. Listen, we'll continue to have that discussion, and maybe one day we'll have to do that. But internally, I struggle with that. But I know it's everywhere, right? The rev share, you know, we have no shot. It's football and basketball. You know, it's football and men's basketball, women's basketball. And Duke is trying to upgrade a bunch of programs in terms of additional scholarship money. I'm not privy to that information. I don't really ask the other coaches, and I think they don't want to say anything to anybody. But I know we're trying, and there are goals that they want to hit, you know, over that 10-year period.
But in the short term, you don't expect the increase in scholarships to have a meaningful effect on your program. Is that fair to say, or is that
Yeah. That's, you know, for us, we would rather have the extra admission spot. To be honest,
yeah.
I'd like to get up to 10. If we could get to 10 a year, you know, add an additional one over the next 4 years, that would be awesome. But again, that's something that we've been for a while.
Yeah. So I want to go back to the notion of time, because one of the things that I know about how you emphasize or what you emphasize in recruiting is getting to know guys. And so while early recruiting had a lot of downsides, it did have more upsides in terms of the duration from when you started to get to know a player and his family to then when he eventually made his college decision was more protracted. We have seen considerable compression of this time. I remember going back to the class of I guess it would have been 21, the group that just graduated, when, you know, two or three of the most prominent players in that class committed the third week in October, right? 50 days after when you were allowed to first contact them. This past class, the rate of players who committed, or the volume of players who committed in September and October on a year-over-year basis compared to the class of 25 was like more than 30% more, which means that it's not simply it's not any program phenomenon. It is an every program phenomenon, and it just suggests that individuals are making decisions, both coaches in terms of offers and players in terms of accepting those offers and committing on compressed time frames. I know that I'm not asking how you feel about it, because I know you don't feel great about it. I'm asking how you manage it and how you try to overcome it on the basis of, are there tactics for trying to get to know people faster? Like, I don't even know if that's a realistic thing.
Yeah, we're as guilty of that as the next guy. You know, we encourage every prospective student athlete to make their visits. You know, we don't care if we're first, last, this strategy, but we want you to be certain that this is the right place for you. Again, I think that come here, you know, very few students leave. You know, we've had one recruited student athlete, maybe 19 years, you know, leave. So they don't, I think they, you know, we kind of force them to think, to make sure that this is the right place. And, you know, and they're happy. They're happy here. They graduate. They have we hope, a full experience here. But you're right. You know, we take them to dinner. We'll go to lunch. We meet our students. We ask our students, any red flag? Did you hear anything? You know, we'll talk to high school coaches. High school coaches are the best resource for us, especially if they're in the building, because they see men every day. They talk to other teachers and other coaches about that young person. So they'll, and especially if we have a good relationship, they'll tell us about the character. You know, the character piece is non-negotiable, right? There's no college in America that can afford to bring in somebody that's character is under question because of the, you know, it's social media, it's their administration. You know, at the end of the day, screw it up for football and basketball. You know, don't bring any publicity.
So, There's something that you kind of included in there that I want to follow up on, because I think my sense is that, and I don't know if this is necessarily intentional from you and your staff or if it's just kind of the nature of the institution, but, you know, my sense is that I feel silly going back to this class of 21, but it does feel appropriate based on the fact that they graduated. I remember being told that was it Tomas Delgado who turned into effectively a Pied Piper for the group and became a rallying force for it. And my sense is that that's not an uncommon thing that happens. Basically, that you kind of get – you have really good internal dynamic within each individual class. Is that a fair characterization? And if so, how do you describe how it comes about? Are you trying to do something there, or is it happening naturally?
No, that's organic. You know, Tomas' father is a Duke grad. His brother was at Duke. And Tomas was a football, wrestler, lacrosse player. He's full of enthusiasm. You never see him without a smile on his face. You know, he's always one of the kids. We got a vibrant personality. And that's just who he is. So, you know, he's coming. Let's go. Who else is coming? You know, and but that's not everybody's way. And to try to make you do that, you know, wouldn't be authentic. It would be real.
So let's get back to lacrosse. And I know that describing it can be challenging. But one of the things that you've also layered in is the role delineation. So, mm-hmm. You know, do you tend to try to, and I realize that, you know, it depends on what the role is, right? So if we're talking about a quarterback of the offense, you probably want to have like one and a half of those on the roster at each time, meaning, you know, the guy who's doing it on game days and then the next guy who's going to be doing it on game days, which suggests you're probably looking at bringing in one of those guys every other year. And, you know, I don't choose that position by accident. It's also one of the scarcest ones to find. So I guess my question more than anything else is, how much does like when you set out to sit, you know, in a lawn chair on the side of a field, are you looking for everything versus are you looking for one specific thing? And you kind of knew that you had an opportunity to find it when you sat down on that particular field.
Yeah, I think, yes. I think your point about the exit is well taken. If you watch PLL, and I've watched it a lot this summer, if you watch the summer, people are all playing. They're all starting in the corner. They're all, you know, getting their corners. You know, it's pick and roll, up, slip, you know, throw the ball forward, throw it back. And that guy at the end is disappearing. And it's not in offensive, you know, schemes, not being taught. So becoming harder to find. But yeah, you look at who can play with both hands, who can play with his head up, and can be that quarterback or point guard for sure. Looking for those lefties, you know, who can just catch and finish. You know, when the game is over, you say, wow, you had a great 10 seconds. You know, the ball was in your stick, out, and you scored 6 goals. You know, and the righty is a little bit more of a, you know, finisher and off ball, you know, obviously you play a lot of different roles. You know, middies, you'd like to find righties and lefties, you know, the face-off guy, God bless you if you can figure out how to, you know, to evaluate that, you know, who's going against who and who's, I have yet to see a video of a face-off man lose a draw.
No doubt.
You know, so it compounds the issue. So, and then defensively, the biggest thing in college is playing off ball. Cause, you know, almost everybody does short stick, you know, it's your ability to find, your ability to recover, your ability to play the passing lane, close out, to pick up tough ground balls at your feet, you know, all those things that are necessary now. It's not necessarily defending the ball, you know, it's doing all those other things.
So the way those two points tie together, the last two comments, one about getting to the time of getting to know prospective student athletes and evaluating them lacrosse players, those things get tied together with your opportunity to coach them. And so by virtue of hosting camps and having prospect days, it gives you that opportunity. How important are those opportunities when it comes to making a decision on whether or not somebody falls into that, call it 20 to 25 player group that is ultimately the A-list that you're reaching out to early in September?
And I say this because I don't want to be a salesman, you know. I'm going to say probably 50% of our current roster have attended at least one prospect day or a camp or something, you know, that we've hosted. And it gave us an opportunity to visit the camp. You know, it's an unofficial visit, meet the staff. I always spent about 45 minutes, almost to an hour with the parents, talking about recruiting and talking about the process. Really Duke, you know,
right,
in particular, but just about the process in general. And, you know, so they get to know a little bit. So they have a little bit of access to questions and answers a little bit. And the players get meet some of our current players. So whether it's McAdory or Brendan O'Neill or some of the guys, I always ask, what would you tell them now, you know, that you knew when if you were a junior again? And so I have them in front of the group a lot because they can speak to, you know, their own experience.
So one element of what I would imagine Andrew and Brennan say is it was harder than I thought it was going to be. I would assume. I don't actually know that to be true. And then separately, your success is determined by your coachability. And that is why I feel like, you know, it's not being a salesman. It is understanding the role that you can watch somebody and you can talk to their coaches, and you can come away with a relatively full picture of who they are. But there is a significant percentage still missing that gets filled in once you get the opportunity to coach the things that you care about because you think they're important, you think they contribute to winning, and then seeing how he responds. So it's only natural in that way that I would imagine it becomes really important, especially when, you know, as we've already established, you know, you're pretty fortunate in terms of the kind of baseline level of athlete that you're looking at to start.
There's no doubt. The coachability, the competitiveness, you know, the desire to want to be the best version of yourself. You know, sometimes, like I could go over and watch maybe somebody play the third game of the day. It's 90 degrees, they're exhausted, and maybe the other team stays, dominates. And the guy I came to watch touches the ball. He touches it twice, and you walk away going, I don't know. You know, I'll see him again.
Totally.
And so you have that. It's not like basketball where there's five guys in the court and you know, your guy's going to touch the ball.
So the last place I want to end is just talking about the dynamic of kind of a staff and how, you know, between you, Matt, Ronnie Caputo, and Kevin Unterstein, you have a lot of experience and a lot of personality on a lot of points of view. It, ultimately, it becomes your job, right? You're the one responsible for, I guess, aggregating all those points of view, distilling them down into one, developing a strategy, and then communicating out to those guys in order to best implement that strategy. How do you describe the conference room conversations? And are they fun? Are they more or less fun than planning practice for the week? And how important they are? How important are they to the lifeblood?
No, it's fun. It's everybody, you know, everybody has a say. Everybody gets to, you know, avoid their opinion. And at the end, it has to be consensus. You know, if there's any red flag whatsoever, it's just not going to work out, you know, for us or for the young man. And we wouldn't put a young man and his family in a situation that wasn't tenable for him. That just wouldn't be fair. Whether that's academically, whether it's socially. And I would say this, that for me, you know, when I talk about being happy, there's four things that I talk to, again, every student about. The first thing is the academic. You know, does this place have what it is that you're looking for? And, you know, we talk a little bit about, obviously, careers and networking, those things. But two is social. Is the place right for you, the right size, location? Do you want to be close to your family? Do you want to be how far away from
right.
you? You want to be, you know. The third thing is, as a young person, how, you know, can you develop as a young man? You know, I'll give you an example. This past year, Naso was a grad assistant. His eligibility was completed, but he was going to school here at Fuqua. He was playing in Village, Saskatchewan. Right. And then he went all the way to the third game of the championship. And on Sundays, was here, he would play violin at the Catholic Mass.
Oh, wow.
Because he'd been playing violin since he was in second grade. Now, here's a guy, all American, was a ACC postgraduate scholarship winner, playing indoor lacrosse, going to graduate school, and playing violin. You know, so does that. space have those things that allow you to become the young, the person that you want to become. And then the last piece is lacrosse. It's not any greater than those three, because if you have that balance of those four, you found the perfect one, right? You're going to graduate. You're going to find a career. Socially, you're going to make the rest of your life. You're going to grow as a young person, and you're going to play lacrosse at the level that you belong.
It's a great note to end on. John Donowski, really appreciate your time on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. You are the best. Can't wait to talk again and get eyes on the Blue Devils in the fall.
Terry, this was awesome. Thanks for the opportunity.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.